Hello and welcome to The Hardy Brain, the show that takes athletic, introverted entrepreneurs and leaders and transforms them into ironclad brain performers. I'm your host, Dr. David Hardy. And today on our show, we've got another amazing guest. He is one of the top 50 most influential podiatrists out there, CEO and medical director of U.S. Neuropathy Centers, and host of the Pod of Inquiry podcast. Welcome to the show, Dr. Stephen Barrett. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Nice to connect with you. And I've been following your show and really appreciate the efforts that everybody makes that's in this space. So look forward to having some fun with you today.
Absolutely. And yeah, your podcast is amazing as well. You've had an in-depth of different kind of approaches that go into health concerns. And of course, being a podiatrist, the leading focus being feet.
Right.
But just for the average listener out there, how important are feet to us? What's going on? What are some of the major conditions out there? And how many people is it affecting?
Well, that's a great question. And that's probably a great five questions.
So
let's break it down a little bit. Let me give you a little history that might answer all of those questions, or at least get us down the pathway to answer them more specifically. But I started in regular podiatric surgery back in the, mid-80s, and did a lot of what would be considered routine reconstructive surgery. And then I happened to cross paths with a gentleman named Lee Dellen, and Lee is a retired professor of plastic and neurosurgery up at Johns Hopkins, and he took me under his wing, and he's still a mentor to me today. But that brought me into the world of peripheral nerve surgery and peripheral nerve pathology, and we had always seen a lot of that in the regular podiatric arena, but never really with the concentrated focus of this is specifically all that you do. Now, I didn't start by saying, okay, all I'm going to do is peripheral nerve. That was a gradual evolution over a period of time. And now I've been doing it probably, well, going on 25 years of just specifically looking at peripheral nerve. And one of the things that I was very, well, I was very humbled by how difficult it is to treat some of these peripheral nerve conditions. And then we really learned very quickly, in a matter of probably less than 5 years, that no matter what magic we could work peripherally, if the central nervous system wasn't right, we didn't do so well. So you can't, medicine tries to divide everything up into these nice and tidy subspecialties, and this is what I focus on. But guess what? There's all of the other bandwidth that's affecting that little portion that you're focusing on. So we got humbled very quickly that we have to treat more than just this particular condition in order to get an optimal outcome for a lot of these patients. Now, it's great when a patient comes in with a very isolated peripheral nerve injury and they haven't had it for a long period of time, and we're able to, you know, accurately diagnose it and take care of it surgically. And 5-6 weeks later, that patient's just like, okay, I'm back. You know, my nerve pain is gone. Unfortunately, that's a smaller subset than the big subset of peripheral nerve pathology. So I learned very quickly that no, we have to start looking at these things from more of a holistic standpoint. What's going on from an inflammatory issue? What is going on with these people that is making them more susceptible to peripheral entrapments? And then a lot of our patient population is diabetic. And of course, diabetic peripheral neuropathy is a very big portion of our practice and our focus and effort. But you have to optimize the patient in order to optimize their outcome from a peripheral nerve standpoint. And so that's kind of been the evolution. And the more we learn, the more we learn that there's that much more to learn. And it's just an ongoing process. Yeah.
Absolutely. Wow. And I would imagine too, in kind of the siloed type healthcare system that's out there, that this has just led to frustration. And Is this one of the reasons why you've branched off and have started to do the education through podcasting as well then?
Yeah, you know, so one of the things that I learned very quickly is that mainstream medicine doesn't have time for a lot of these issues, and they don't really have interest in a lot of these issues. And these folks are so busy that, you know, they're spending maybe 3 or 4 minutes with a patient and seeing 70 patients in a day. And, you know, so what can you do for a patient in that type of a situation? You're a busy clinician and you're trying to get through your day, you write a prescription and, you know, off to see the next patient. So it's a system by default that when you get these patients that have these complex problems, then it became incumbent upon us to really say, okay, listen, we got to figure out what's going on. Now, we don't treat all of these things. If we're able to identify some kind of a low back issue or some type of a metabolic issue, we're going to get them to the appropriate specialists in that area. But we have to be cognizant of all of this stuff and then be able to build that into our treatment plan so that we can be successful. So that's kind of what's happened in our practice.
But what a service, though, to provide to people is to actually be able to say, no, this isn't an issue with your feet. It's a problem with your diabetes, or it's a problem in your lower back. And right. They haven't heard that before because, well, no, it's my foot's hurting, or it's right here. How often do you think that occurs? And what sort of conditions are you seeing where it is more so a combination of things going on other than maybe diabetes?
Well, that's a great question. I don't have a number off the top of my head, but
that's fine.
But I can tell you that it's a greater majority that have multiple system involvement than that one rare, okay, this is just totally isolated at. And that's, I think that's some of the problem with specialization. Because if you think, let's take diabetic peripheral neuropathy, or let's take diabetic metabolic impairment, if you want to just call it that. All right.
Yes, yeah.
So what happens with the patient that has diabetes? Well, they develop peripheral neuropathy. So you get a specialist that will take care of the peripheral nerve component, but then they have kidney issues. So then they'll see the nephrologist, and then they have peripheral arterial disease. And so then they're seeing the vascular surgeons, and they may be dealing with wounds, and then they may have thyroid issues. And there's all of these systems that are affected where we have all of these specialists plugged in. You've got the endocrinologist who's into thyroid. You've got the endocrinologist who's into things other than thyroid. You have the peripheral vascular surgeon. So we're all treating the same thing. You know,
right.
it would be great to say, well, maybe we should just try to make this patient healthy. And
yes,
all of these things, or many of them, a lot of times, if they don't go away completely, they are mitigated tremendously. And so I think the cornerstone in my mind right now is you have to look at the patient from a whole, what are they doing metabolically? What are they doing psychologically? You know, I mean, this may shock you, but probably 15% of our patient population with chronic nerve pain is suicidal. And so, you know, you're treating some pretty, even though it may be a nerve down in the bottom of the foot or at the side of their knee or whatever, these things have great effect on the whole human.
Oh, absolutely. And I love the example where you started to dive into wound care, kidneys, thyroid, and then peripheral neuropathy. And most people out there do think they're separate issues. But underlining is that the tissue, these small little vessels, are starting to deteriorate. And when they deteriorate in the feet, they're deteriorating probably everywhere that kind of has these small vessels or these small little nerve endings. And it's going to cause major issues systemically. And one part of the body might be affected more or first, but eventually all of them are going to be. And
right.
This is just amazing stuff to see that, yeah, there are centers people can go to that they get kind of that overall arching theme, besides just being passed on to the next specialist. And
right.
How did you come about then becoming the medical director then for US neuropathy then? And what was kind of the journey down that pathway then?
Well, you know, when I started seeing these patients specifically with lower extremity peripheral nerve issues and pathology, the more you see of that, then the more you get of that. If that makes sense, right? You know, it's not like there was never any grand marketing design that says, you know, we're going to create this big, focus on neuropathy. It was the reverse of that. It was these patients coming in because other patients had been, in the practice or whatever. And then all of a sudden, there's more and more of these folks with peripheral neuropathy. And then we looked at the whole system. And then that was the genesis or the impetus behind trying to develop strictly a peripheral neuropathy center. Because even the university-based systems are very fragmented in many situations. It's not to say that they're not great and that they don't have incredible diagnostic capabilities, but sometimes they get so esoteric that they don't see, the whole picture. And then other times, just like in all of mainstream medicine and really all of functional medicine, is this person is a specialist in this little area within that bigger specialty, but they don't talk to the other people as much. And so you end up with this very fragmented system. And so we thought that the best way to, at least for us to try to deliver a better model of care would be to have just a focus on peripheral neuropathy. And it's complex. So like I said, the complexity of these patients and their conditions forced us into expanding our blinders we were forced into this. And then that's kind of led to the development, the concept of US neuropathy centers.
Wow. Now that's a lot of work that has gone into this. And obviously, yeah, people listening in can tell your passion about helping and serving the patients coming in. And kind of circling back to what you had mentioned earlier with basically that, yeah, if nerves are deteriorating in the feet, then other tissues are probably deteriorating as well. And kind of your passion now to also start thinking of the central nervous system more. You had mentioned that you had a family member with Alzheimer's as well. Can you kind of talk to us what was going on and how your brain was kind of dealing with both these conditions then?
Well, sadly, in 2020, my mother passed away with Alzheimer's disease. And it's a very traumatic, not only for the individual, but for all the caregivers and family members and that type of thing. And a lot of people, and myself included, say that, with the Alzheimer's patient, they die twice. And yeah, they have their mental death that precedes their physical death. And it's if you look at it from the totality of how it robs this person of their being, right? I mean, we as humans, what are we? We are our thoughts and memories and our interaction with other people. And when all that's taken away, you're left with a physical vessel. But it's just a biological organism that doesn't have the brain, the mind, all of these central characteristics of being a human. So it's a traumatic thing for anybody that has to put somebody into memory care and live through that. That got me looking into more and more things from a CNS standpoint of what can be integrated to help people, not only with Alzheimer's, but with really any type of central nervous system manifestation of maybe a peripheral nerve pain generator. So, there's many things that we can do, not us specifically, but we can identify things and get them to the right specialists. Like, for example, one thing that we will look at frequently is transcranial magnetic stimulation. And so, you know, we're able to refer folks into centers that are excellent with that. And that actually delivers energy to the brain and can affect plasticity changes positive in that patient's CNS. And so those are all of the things. I mean, gosh, you can look at methylene blue, red light, all of these different modalities. That, I mean, there's a lot out there.
Yes.
So when you're dealing with your patient, if you don't know about any of these things, it's hard to craft a good treatment plan for them. So that's kind of, you know, it's a little tangential going from Alzheimer's to all of the CNS, but that's kind of what led me into that focus on the CNS, as well as the fact that we just couldn't get some patients better, right? They just from a neurotransmitter standpoint, all of these things. So, you know, again, it's the complexity of everything. So you have to basically look in other specialties in order to be able to know where to refer out of your own specialty, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense, but also just having the awareness and knowledge that, yeah, there's healing modalities, whether it's magnetic stimulation, but yeah, in a peripheral nerve, we're also using different stimulations like electric modalities, right, nerve stimulations, cold laser, all these things to help that tissue healing process to occur. And yeah, if a nerve's dying off in the foot, there's a good chance that the nerves or neurons in the brain are also dying off. That
right.
They're the same tissue. It's the nervous system.
Well, and
but I also want. Oh, sorry.
Think about, let me interrupt because you brought up a great point. Well, let's take diabetes. Okay.
Yes.
So we know without a doubt diabetes has tremendous CNS manifestations. And if you look at some of the new stuff, what are they referring to Alzheimer's as? Type 3 diabetes.
Diabetes, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So let's say you have this patient that comes in and their first symptom may be neuropathy, tingling and burning in their toes or lower extremities. And they may be very early onset Alzheimer's. And now if you just don't look at anything but the toes, you're not going to do anything to optimize that patient. But if you look at this patient, you see that their A1C is really high, they're out of control, all of these different things, and you're able to get them back and not only get their peripheral nerve issue taken care of, what are you doing long-term from a longevity standpoint to maybe you're not going to prevent them from having Alzheimer's, but maybe you can prevent them from having the seriousness that they would have without otherwise being treated. And maybe you put it off altogether. You know, Dale Bredesen wrote a great book, Reversing Alzheimer's. And, you know, that kind of rocked the boat a lot, you know, because people mm-hmm. said, oh, you can't put reversing with Alzheimer's. I mean, that's verboten, you know.
Right.
But so I think that's kind of a consideration too. So when we're helping people with these problems in their lower extremity, we're also helping them with maybe preventing bigger CNS manifestations.
Oh, big time. And on that point as well, just to build on it, the CNS, the brain, is fed by peripheral nerves. The stimulation going to the brain is coming in from all these receptors that go through a nerve up the spinal cord and into the brain. And it is one of these things. If you don't get that stimulation or feedback from the body, that part of the brain starts to shrink and atrophy and has downturn effects.
And a great example of that is, let's say we have a damaged nerve that you cannot repair. So we're going to end up doing a procedure that would be called a denervation procedure. We're doing something to take that nerve out. We're cutting it. We're trying to, you know, transplant it into a quiet place or whatever. But guess what happens? When you denervate that peripheral nerve, there's a spot now on the cerebral cortex that's not getting that feedback on that cortical map. And yes, the cortical map doesn't like that. The brain doesn't like to have this area that's not getting any stimulation stimulation. And so what does it do? It fires up the other peripheral nerves around that area of deficit in order to try to overcome what has been taken away. And a great example of this is the optic nerve, right? People don't think about this all the time, but you've got this. If you look, like we're looking at each other right now, and I don't see this big dark spot right in the middle of your face, because what's my occipital cortex doing? It's filling in the area that's not getting stimulation because the receptors are not there in that part of the eye because the optic nerve is there, right? But the brain fills it in. We don't walk around seeing these black holes and everything. Right. It just shows you how marvelous this brain physiology is. I mean, it's extraordinary. The more you learn about it, the more you're like, wow, you know,
it's fascinating. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And on top of that, yeah, if you don't know where your feet are, then balance is the next issue to go. And we all know that in elderly people, falls are traumatic and can lead to a lot of serious issues, if not even early mortality. And that's a thing out there. The other is the perception of pain. And I know you really want to touch on this one, is that the pain might not be in the foot, that the whole perception of pain is actually going on in the brain and the central nervous system. And there's conditions out there like complex regional pain syndromes. I'm just going to throw it to you and see where you kick the ball on this one.
No, that's a great, there's a lot there to unpack for sure. You know, I think one of the biggest difficulties for clinicians is figuring out, is it coming from the low back, or is it a peripheral nerve entrapment, or is it a brain issue? And I'll give you an example. Drop foot happens. It's a pretty significant thing. All right. It can happen after a low back injury. It can happen after a stroke. It can happen after a total knee arthroplasty, but sometimes it's very difficult. How do we figure out where this focus of or the pain generator, where is that? Is it really coming from the low back, or is it really coming more from a peripheral standpoint? Now, there are some things that we can do that help us with these diagnostic conundrums. One of them is peripheral nerve blocks. If we're able to give a very small amount of lidocaine next to the nerve under ultrasound guidance, and improved function is seen, then we know that, well, they may have a CNS issue, but we also know that they have a PNS issue. And if we can take care of the peripheral nerve system, that may overcome the central manifestations. I'll give you an example. One of the things that we discovered back in 2017 was a diagnostic response to a peripheral nerve block that we now call it the Phoenix sign. And we put in about 0.3 cc, which is literally just a couple of drops in a teaspoon of local anesthetic. And if you put it next to that nerve, if they have a focal nerve entrapment at that spot, then in about 4 minutes, they'll have more motor strength. So they may go from 2 out of 5 motor strength to 5 out of 5 motor strength. And you know now, because of the response to this peripheral nerve block, that it's not coming from the central nervous system. Now, it is, I'll give you an example on some patients, stroke patients, right? So stroke patients will many times have a manifestation of a drop foot. And the reason they'll have that manifestation is because there's a place in the brain that has had this traumatic damage from the stroke itself, and that causes it. But there are times when the stroke patient also has a peripheral nerve injury. What happens when a patient has a stroke? A lot of times they fall down. They And so they may twist their leg enough to injure the common peroneal nerve, and it just gets blown off. It's like, oh, that's part of your stroke. There's nothing you can do about it. They put you in a brace, and now you have this balance issue the rest of your life if you're lucky enough to survive this event. But if these patients will show a response to this peripheral nerve block, the Phoenix sign, we know that they had a stroke, but they also injured that nerve on the way down or when they were put in the hospital gurney because their legs set up next to the rail too long, lots of different things. And so now that's the power of a diagnostic test like that, because patients will not have to live with this thing. And you made a great comment about balance and falls. I don't know the exact statistic, but I think after the age of 65, falls are the leading cause of death.
It's up there, yes.
Yeah. I think you'd have to fact check.
I think you're correct on it, though.
Yeah. So anytime you can improve a patient's ability to ambulate and improve their balance, you have extended their life, without a doubt.
Oh, absolutely. Now, we've talked a lot about pathology. What about the other side of the spectrum, though, for performance? And like just the foot dynamics, the muscles, the way it should be moving, sitting, maybe helping athletes to perform better, to be able to do that marathon. What would kind of be your advice there for keeping your feet healthy or to build the right position, the muscles in your feet, the posture that's going to ultimately impact your knees, your hips, your lower back, all the way up?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that gets ignored a lot is what is the biomechanics of the lower extremity really doing? Is that nerve issue really an issue of mechanics? And I give people this analogy all the time because almost everybody has a car. And I said to the patient, you know, if the tire on the front driver's side tire keeps wearing out and you just go put a new tire on that all the time, every 6 months you get a new tire. Well, that's not really very good auto, maintenance.
Right? Exactly.
Because the car's out of alignment. That's why the tire's wearing out. And a lot of times we will have patients that have a condition that's called equinus. And equinus is it comes from equine, the way that, you know, if you look at a horse's hoof, it hangs off a little bit more at an angle. It doesn't have the ability to be dorsiflexed like this, like you would ideally want. And then when that patient has equinus, which is most often congenital, then they will have increased pressure and increased duration of time on their foot. And a great example of this, where hundreds of people, if not thousands, get maybe misdiagnosed or only partially diagnosed is with a condition called Morton's neuroma. And I hate to use the word neuroma because I always refer to it as Morton's metatarsalgia or Morton's entrapment or just Morton's pinched nerve, okay? Because in order to get a neuroma, you have to cut the nerve or hurt the nerve in some form or fashion to get a neuroma. So now if you cut a nerve out for Morton's entrapment, you will get a recurrent Morton's neuroma. There it's okay to use that nomenclature. But guess what? The mainstream rarely looks at anything except that hot little nerve in the ball of this person's foot. And they don't make the global evaluation that's needed, because this nerve's only entrapped because that patient has this condition that is increasing the pressure in the forefoot and the duration that pressure exists. And so why are you going to treat this little thing if you don't treat the alignment of the body? Like, you're just putting a new tire that's going to wear out very quickly. And so a lot of people are really harmed by that because they haven't had a complete diagnosis. But guess what happens with people that have equinus? Then they develop pedal issues like flat feet, and that leads to an increase in ACL injuries, and it increased pelvic tilt and all of these different things. So you have to really look at the whole thing.
Amazingly, once again, I couldn't expect a better answer on that. On top of all of this and the passion and the knowledge you've had, you've also developed a couple procedures, have you not? And can you just speak to the innovation side then too of your career and where that's taken you?
Oh man, yeah, that I've been very blessed. In early 1990s, I developed a procedure called endoscopic plantar fasciotomy. It was the first endoscopic procedure of the foot to treat plantar fasciitis. And again, I hate to use plantar fasciitis because it's really more of a plantar fasciopathy. It's more of a degenerative condition rather than an inflammatory condition. But yes. Anyhow, you can get into the weeds too much, you know, with that type of stuff. But anyhow, we ended up training over probably 20 years after we developed that procedure, about 6,000 surgeons throughout the world. It's still a very common procedure. It works very well. Now, clearly we are much better in the way we're able to treat plantar fasciopathy now because we have regenerative medicine. We've got, you know, amnio products and PRP and I like peptides myself. So there's a lot of ability to treat the plantar fascia without surgery. But when you do need surgery, EPF still has a very high success rate with a very low complication rate. So it's still a procedure. So it's still a widely used procedure. And then after we developed that procedure, then I developed a procedure called the EDEN technique. It stands for endoscopic decompression of intermetatarsal nerve, which is basically the Morton's neuroma, really the Morton's entrapment. And prior to the development of that, which was in about 1993, the standard of care is just cut the nerve out if you can't get it better with a bunch of alcohol injections or steroid injections or all these other kind of wild things, you know. But those are nerve destructive procedures for a nerve that's just entrapped. And so if a nerve is just entrapped, the best way to take care of it is to just unentrap it and don't mess the nerve up. And so prior to us introducing that in 1993, the standard of care was just cut the nerve out. And then, you know, it was always proffered in the literature that that's 85% effective. And the answer to that is that 85%, it's kind of like they say, if you tell a lie 1,000 times, it becomes your truth.
Yes, that's what it is.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. I mean, two guys from the Campbell Clinic, Womack and Richardson, came out, published, I forget, it was around 2010, but they went back and looked at their patients, and 50% of them had either a poor or not so good result. So where this 85% number comes from, I don't know, but I can tell you that when you cut out a nerve that's just entrapped and you actually damage that nerve, you've set that patient up for a potential central nervous system manifestation of chronic pain. And, you know, so it's kind of like, well, do you want to go play soccer in a really nice, safe neighborhood, or do you want to go into a really bad neighborhood? The chances of you getting hurt in a really bad neighborhood are going to be much, you know, much more likely. And that's the case with Morton's entrapment. So those were the two procedures that we kind of developed. And, you know, it's been great because when you teach, you learn. All right. And a lot of, every time I go to teach something, I always end up learning more, I think, than right. I teach. Yes. It's a great way to, you know, get excited and stay excited.
Absolutely. Now, you've mentioned the progression of several different things that have happened in your career. You've interviewed a lot of people coming in with more therapies, more modalities. What would be one thing that you're like just juiced about and hope gets more traction as things kind of advance or knowledge advances in this field?
Yeah, that's man, that's a great question. Because to find the one, I mean, there's probably more like a handful.
Yes, yeah, there is.
Yeah. I think that the modalities that are, you know, really for us from a, like if we take these patients that they've had six or seven operations and they're, you know, disasters. I think probably the one thing that may be up there high on that list is peripheral nerve stimulation. So in contradistinction of a spinal cord stimulator, we can implant a peripheral nerve stimulator. And in many cases, that does extremely well for the patient. So you've taken these patients that really are not great surgical candidates because they've had all of the surgery, or they may have had, you know, some type of trauma where, you know, they've been badly burned or crush injuries, that you just can't really go in and operate on those areas without a high risk of wound dehiscence and potential infection, loss of limb. So we're able to come up higher out of the bad neighborhood into the better neighborhood that they can tolerate, and through a smaller procedure, implant a, you know, peripheral nerve stimulation lead, and then that gives them some control over it. So that's really been probably one of the best things that I've been able to integrate over the last 5 to 10 years.
Wow. This is amazing knowledge, and I've got a feeling people are going to want to reach out to you and find out more. How do they find you?
Well, probably the best way is just go to usneuropathycenters.com, and that'll, you know, bring you into, you know, what we're doing and how to get a hold of us.
Absolutely. And then your podcast is available?
Podcast is available, the Pod of Inquiry, and you're going to be on it in a few months. And they can go to podofinquiry.com and access it, or it's on all of the Apple and Spotify and all of that.
Excellent. Definitely check out all this amazing information, and stay tuned to the next episode of The Hardy Brain, the show that takes athletic introverted entrepreneurs and leaders and transforms them into ironclad brain performers. Take care.